And whoever insists either that our sight reaches the sun, or else that the sun is not reflected onto us by the moon itself, is being naive. He requires the eye to be a sun, sight to be light, and man to be heaven. For it is likely that the sun's reflection, on account of its force and brightness, travels toward us from the moon with something like a blow. But our sight, being weak and thin and scant, what wonder is it if it neither delivers a repelling blow nor, in rebounding, preserves its continuity, but instead breaks up and falls short, having no abundance of light with which to avoid being torn apart amid the unevenness and roughness. For from water and other mirrors, while it is still strong and close to its starting point, it is not impossible for the reflection to leap on to the sun. But from the moon, even if some slippages of it occur, they will be weak and faint and will give out before arriving, because of the length of the distance. Besides, concave mirrors make the reflected ray more intense than the incoming ray, so that they often send up actual flames, whereas convex and spherical mirrors, because they do not offer resistance from every side, make it weak and dim. You surely observe, whenever two rainbows appear, one cloud enclosing another, that the enclosing one makes the colors dim and indistinct, for the outer cloud, lying farther from the eye, does not give back a vigorous or strong reflection. And why should I say more? Where the sun's light, reflected from the moon, loses all its heat, and only a thin, feeble remnant of its brightness reaches us with difficulty, is it likely that sight, traveling the same double course, could have any portion left over to reach the sun from the moon? I, for one, do not think so. Consider this too, I said, you yourselves. If sight were affected the same way toward water as toward the moon, then the full moon would have to produce images of earth and plants and men and stars, as the rest of mirrors do. But if no reflections of sight occur with respect to these, because of its weakness or the moon's roughness, then let us not demand them with respect to the sun either. We, then, I said, have reported as much as has not escaped our memory of what was said there. It is time now to call on Sulla, or rather to require his account of himself, since he has been, as it were, a listener under contract to repay us. So, if it please you, let us break off our walk, and sitting down on the benches, provide him with a settled audience. This was agreed, and when we had sat down, Theon said, I myself, Lamprias, desire no less than any of you to hear what is to be told. But first I would gladly hear about those said to inhabit the moon, not whether some in fact dwell there, but whether it is even possible to dwell there. For if it is not possible, then it is absurd even to hold that the moon is earth. For it will seem to have come into being for nothing, in vain, neither bearing fruit nor furnishing any seat, origin, or way of life for any beings, for the sake of which, we say, this body too has come to be, according to Plato, our nurse, and the exact guardian and maker of day and night. And you see how much is said about these things, both in jest and in earnest. Some say that those who dwell beneath the moon hang, as it were, like Tantaluses over their own heads, while those who in turn dwell upon it are bound to it like Ixions, with such violent force, although it moves with no single motion, but, as it is somehow also called, goddess of the three ways, being carried at once in length along the zodiac, and in breadth, and in depth. Of which motions the astronomers name one revolution, another spiral, and another I do not know how anomaly, although they see nothing anomalous or disordered in its returns. So then, if some lion once fell, by the force of this motion, into the Peloponnese, that is no cause for wonder. The wonder is rather that we do not constantly see countless fallings of men and violent expulsions of lives from up there, tumbling and turning over as it were. And indeed, it is absurd to raise doubts about the dwelling of those beings there, on the ground that they cannot have origin or composition. For where the Egyptians and the troglodytes, for whom the sun stands directly overhead for the merest instant of a single day at the solstice and then departs, come close to being scorched by the dryness of the surrounding air, surely it is likely that those on the moon endure 12 summers every year, since the sun, month by month, stands directly over them and stays fixed whenever there is a full moon. As for winds and clouds and rains, without which plants can neither come to be nor survive once they have, it is impossible to conceive of these forming there, because of the heat and thinness of the surrounding air. For not even here do the high parts of mountains receive the wild, opposing storms, but the air there, already unsettled by its own lightness, escape such condensation and thickening unless, by Zeus, we are to say that, just as Athena dripped nectar and ambrosia into Achilles when he refused food. So the moon, called and in fact being Athena, nourishes her men, sending up for them a daily ambrosia, as Pharisees of old supposed the gods themselves to feed. As for the Indian root which Megasthenes says those who neither eat nor drink, but are sweet of breath, singe and burn as incense, and are nourished by its scent, where could one get such a root growing there, since the moon is never rained upon? When Theon had said this, "Most excellent," I said, "and best of all, you have smoothed our frowning brows with the playfulness of your speech, and on that account we too take courage for our reply, not expecting too bitter or too severe a reckoning. For indeed those who are exceedingly harsh and distrustful about such matters, unwilling calmly to examine what is possible and what may be, are truly no different from those who are excessively convinced of them. So then, in the first place, it is not necessary if men do not inhabit the moon that it should have come to be in vain and for nothing. For we do not see even this earth of ours active or inhabited throughout its whole extent, but only a small part of it, as it were certain headlands or peninsulas rising out of the deep, is fruitful of animals and plants. While of the rest, some parts are desolate and barren from storms and droughts, and most has sunk beneath the great sea. But you, who always love and admire Aristarchus, do you not hear Crates reciting? Ocean, who has been made the source for all men and gods alike, sends forth over most of the earth. Yet it is far from true that these things have come to be in vain. Indeed, the sea sends up soft exhalations and the sweetest of winds when summer is at its height, while from the uninhabited, frozen regions the snows, gently melting, relax and scatter. Of day and night, it stands exact, fixed in the middle, guardian, according to Plato, and maker. Nothing, then, prevents the moon likewise from being empty of living creatures, while still providing reflections for the light diffused about it, and a confluence and blending for the rays of the stars within it, by which it also helps digest the exhalations rising from the earth, and at the same time tempers the excessive fieriness and harshness of the sun. And perhaps, granting something also to ancient report, we shall say she was thought to be Artemis herself, as a virgin and childless, yet otherwise helpful and beneficial. Furthermore, dear Theon, none of the things you have said proves the reputed habitation on the moon impossible. For its whirling motion, possessing much gentleness and calm, smooths the air and distributes it as it is set in order together with the moon, so that there is no fear that those who have lived there would fall off and be dislodged. And the change and this varied, wandering character of its motion is not a mark of irregularity or disorder, rather. The astronomers demonstrate a wonderful order and course in these very things, resolving it by certain circles unwound about other circles, some making the moon stationary, others making it carried back and forth smoothly and evenly at constant speeds. For it is these mountings and revolutions of the circles, and their relations to one another and to us, that most harmoniously bring to completion the apparent heights and depths of its motion, together with its deviations in latitude, along with its periods in longitude. As for the great heat and continuous burning from the sun that you fear, you will stop fearing it once you set the full moons against the 11 summer conjunctions. You will find that the continuity of the change, since the extremes do not last long, produces its own proper blending and strips away the excess of each. And lying midway between these, it has, as is likely, a season most akin to spring. Moreover, toward us it sends its heat down through murky, resistant air, nourished together with the rising exhalations. But there, the air being thin and translucent, scatters and disperses the ray, since it has no fuel and no body to sustain it. Its produce and fruits are nourished here by rains, but elsewhere, as, for example, up around Thebes in your country and seeing the earth, drinking not rainwater but water native to itself, and making use of winds and dews, would not wish, I think, to trade its fruitfulness, owing to a certain excellence and blending, for that of the land most rained upon. The very same kinds of plants among us, if pressed hard by winter, bear much fine fruit. But in Libya, and among you in Egypt, they are quite susceptible to cold and fearful of winters. As for the land of Jedrosia and the troglodyte country, which reaches to the ocean, being unfruitful through dryness and utterly treeless, In the neighboring and circling sea, wonderful growths of plants are nourished and flourish even in the depths, some of which they call olives, others laurels, others the locks of Isis. And the plants called resurrection plants, once pulled out of the earth, not only live on hanging for as long as one likes, but actually put forth shoots. Some crops are sown before winter, others at the height of summer, like sesame and millet. And thyme, or centaury, if sown in good, rich soil and watered and irrigated, departs from its natural quality and loses its potency, but rejoices in drought and thrives when kept to what is proper to it. And if, as they say, it cannot even bear the dew, like most Arabian plants, but is dimmed and spoiled by being moistened, what wonder is it if there grow, around the moon, roots and seeds and matter that need no rains or snows at all, but are naturally well suited to a warm, thin air? And how is it not likely that winds should rise, warmed by the moon and by the agitation of its revolution, and that gentle breezes should accompany it, and that light dews and moisture should be poured around it, and, being scattered, should suffice for the things that sprout, while the moon itself, in its own blending, is neither fiery nor parched, but soft and productive of moisture? For no effect of dryness reaches us from it, but much of moisture and of the feminine growth of plants, decay of meats, turnings and relaxings of wines, softenings of wood, easy deliveries for women. But I am wary of stirring up and provoking Pharnaces again, now that he is quiet, by bringing forward the ocean's floodings, as they themselves put it, and the swellings of straits, as these are dispersed and increased by the moon through its moistening power. So I shall turn instead to you, dear Theon, for it is you who tell us, in expounding these words of Alcmen, the daughter of Zeus, Dew, and divine Selene Nourish, that here he calls the air Zeus, and says that, being moistened by the moon, it turns into dew. For it seems, my friend, that the moon has a nature opposed to the sun's. Since not only does she soften and disperse whatever he condenses and dries, but she also moistens and cools the heat that comes from him, as it falls upon her and mingles with her. Both those who suppose the moon to be a fiery, blazing body are mistaken, and those who demand that the creatures there require, for their origin, nourishment, and way of life, everything that creatures here require, seem blind to the irregularities in nature, among which one can find greater and more numerous differences and dissimilarities between living things themselves than between living things and non-living things. And let there be no fine-mouthed men who are nourished by smells, I do not think such men exist at all. But as for the power that Ammonius himself expounded to us, Hesiod hinted at it when he said, "Nor how much benefit there is in mallow and asphodel, a great boon." Epimenides made this evident in practice, teaching that nature, with only a small kindling, revives and sustains a living creature, so that if it receives just the size of an olive, it needs no further nourishment. As for the inhabitants of the moon, if indeed they exist, it is plausible that they are slight of body and can be sustained by whatever comes their way. For indeed the moon itself, like the sun, itself a fiery living creature, and many times larger than the earth, is said to be nourished from the moisture that rises from the earth, and the other stars too, though they are countless in number. So they suppose that the region above bears creatures light and frugal in their necessities. But we fail to perceive both this and the fact that a different region, a different nature, and a different temperament is suited to them. Just as if, when we were unable to approach the sea or even touch it, but only gazed at the sight of it from afar and learned that its water is bitter, undrinkable, and salty, someone were to tell us that in its depths it nourishes many great creatures of every shape, and is full of beasts that use water just as we use air, this would seem like tales and marvels brought to their conclusion. So too, it seems, we are in the same condition and suffer the same thing with regard to the moon, disbelieving that any men dwell there. Yet I think that those inhabitants, for their part, would be far more astonished at the earth, looking upon it as a kind of sediment and dregs of the universe, appearing dimly through mists and clouds and moisture, a lightless, low, and motionless region, if it produces and nourishes living creatures that share in motion, breath, and warmth. And if they should ever happen to hear these Homeric lines, "Dreadful, dank places, which even the gods abhor, and as far beneath Hades as heaven is from earth," they would say that these words are spoken quite literally about this region, and that Hades and Tartarus are situated here, while the moon alone is earth, standing at an equal distance from those regions above and these regions below. While I was still speaking, more or less, Sulla broke in and said, "Hold on, Lamprias and Bolt, shut the little door of your discourse, lest, before you know it, you run your myth aground on the earth, so to speak, and throw into confusion my own drama, which has a different stage setting and arrangement. I am, after all, its actor, though I will first name for you its poet, if nothing prevents it, beginning in Homeric fashion. A certain island, Ajaja, lies far off in the sea, 5 days' sail from Britain for one sailing westward, and 3 other islands, lying at an equal distance from it and from one another, lie roughly toward the setting of the summer sun. On one of these, the natives tell in myth, Cronus is imprisoned by Zeus, while his son keeps watch as guardian over those islands and over the sea which they call the Cronian Sea. Beyond them lies the great continent, by which the great outer sea is encircled all around, at a lesser distance from the other islands, but about 5,000 stads from Ajaja, for one traveling by oared ships, for the sea there is slow to cross and muddy on account of the multitude of currents. And these currents flow out from the great continent, and deposits are formed from them, making the sea heavy and earthy, for which reason it has even gained the reputation of being frozen solid. Of that continent, Greeks dwell on the parts near the sea, around a gulf no smaller than the Maeotic Lake, whose mouth lies almost directly opposite the mouth of the Caspian Sea. And these Greeks speak of and consider themselves mainlanders, while calling the inhabitants of this land of ours islanders, on the ground that it too is washed all around by the sea. They believe that those who came with Heracles and were left behind there later mingled with the people of Cronus, and that the Greek element there, which was already dying out and being overpowered by the barbarian tongue and by foreign laws and customs, was as it were rekindled and became strong and numerous again, and that this is why Heracles is held in first honor there and Cronus in second. So whenever the star of Cronus, which we call Phaenon, but which those people, he said, call Nycteros, enters Taurus, which happens every 30 years, they spend a long time preparing for the sacrifice and the voyage, then send off, by lot, in as many ships as are needed, men chosen along with a large retinue and the provisions necessary for those about to row across so great a stretch of sea and to live a long time in a foreign land. Once they have put out to sea, they meet with various fortunes, as one might expect, different men differently. Those who survive the crossing put in first at the islands lying off the coast, which are inhabited by Greeks, and there they see the sun disappear for less than 1 hour, over 30 days, this being their night, which has a light darkness, twilight-like, glowing from the west. After spending 90 days there, held sacred and treated with honor and hospitality, and addressed as such, they are at last carried across by favoring winds. No one else dwells there except themselves and those sent out before them. For while it is permitted for those who have served the god together for 30 years to sail back home, most of them choose, understandably enough, to settle there for good, some out of habit, others because all things are available to them in abundance, without toil or trouble, while they spend their time amid sacrifices and festivals, or continually occupied with certain studies and with philosophy. For the nature of the island, they say, is wonderful, and so is the mildness of the surrounding air. And to some who plan to sail away, the divine power itself even stands in their way, appearing to them as to familiars and friends, not only in dreams and by omens, but many meet it openly, face to face, in visions and voices of demons. As for Cronus himself, he lies asleep, enclosed in a deep cave of gold-gleaming rock, for sleep has been contrived by Zeus as a bond to hold him, while birds fly in over the summit of the rock and bring him ambrosia, and the whole island is filled with fragrance, spreading from the rock as from a spring. And those demons attend and serve Cronus, having become his companions in the time when he reigned over gods and men. These demons, being themselves possessed of prophetic power, foretell many things on their own account, but the greatest matters, concerning the greatest things, they proclaim as they come down from the dreams of Cronus, for whatever Zeus premeditates, Cronus dreams. The titanic passions and motions of the soul in him are utterly stilled by sleep, so that what is kingly and divine in him remains by itself, pure and unmixed. It was to this place, then, that the stranger said he had been brought, And there, while attending upon the god at his leisure, he acquired as much knowledge of astronomy as one who has studied geometry can advance to, together with the rest of philosophy, so far as it can be pursued by natural methods. He also felt a certain desire and longing to become an eyewitness of the great continent for that, it seems, is what they call our inhabited world. So, when the 30 years had elapsed, and the men who were to relieve him arrived from home, he bade his friends farewell and sailed off, lightly equipped in other respects, but carrying a considerable supply of provisions in golden cups. Now what he experienced and how many peoples he passed through, encountering sacred writings and being initiated into every kind of mystery rite, is not the work of a single day to relate, as he himself reported to us, recalling everything most exactly and in detail. But listen to what is relevant to our present discussion. He spent the greatest part of his time at Carthage, since the god is held in great honor among us there, and because he discovered certain sacred hide scrolls, which had been secretly carried off when the earlier city was being destroyed and had lain hidden in the ground undetected for a long time. He said that, of the visible gods, one ought, and he urged me too, to honor the moon especially, as being most sovereign over life and closely bound up with it. When I expressed my astonishment at this and asked to hear it more clearly explained, he said, "Many things, Sulla, are said among the Greeks about the gods, but not all of them correctly. For instance, though they are right to name Demeter and Cori, they are wrong to suppose that both are in one and the same place together. For the one has dominion over the things around the earth, and is in the earth, while the other is in the moon and has dominion over the things around the moon. She is called both Cori and Persephone, the latter name because she is a light bringer, the former because we also give the name Cori, pupil, to that part of the eye in which the image of the beholder is reflected back, just as the light of the sun is seen reflected in the moon. And in what is said about their wandering and their search for one another, there is truth, for when apart they long for one another, and they are often entwined about the shadow. But that Cori is now in heaven and light, now in darkness and night, is no falsehood, though the reckoning of the time has caused an error in the number. For it is not for 6 months, but at intervals of 6 months that we see her taken by the earth's shadow, as if by her mother, and only rarely does this happen to her at intervals of 5 months. For it is impossible for her ever to leave Hades altogether, since she is the boundary of Hades. Just as Homer, too, veiling his meaning, put it not badly when he spoke of the Elysian plain and the ends of the earth. For where the shadow of the earth, extending outward, comes to an end, that is the point he set as the limit and boundary of the earth. To this place no base or impure person ascends, but the good, once conveyed there after death, live out a life that is thus very easy, though not yet blessed or divine, until their second death. And what is this second death, Sulla? Do not ask me about that now, for I am about to explain it myself. Most people are right to consider man a composite being, but wrong to think him composed of only two elements. For they suppose that mind is somehow a part of the soul, erring no less than those who think the soul a part of the body. For mind is superior to, and more divine than soul, by as much as soul is superior to body. Now the union of soul and body produces the irrational and passionate element, while the union of mind and soul produces reason, of which the one is the source of pleasure and pain, the other of virtue and vice. Of these three constituents joined together, the earth furnished the body, the moon the soul, and the sun furnished the mind for our generation, just as the sun in turn furnishes the moon with light. As for the death that we die, the one death makes man two out of three, and the other makes one out of two. The former takes place in the domain of Demeter, on the earth itself, which is why the Athenians of old called the dead Demeter's people, while the latter takes place in the moon, in the domain of Persephone. And each of these deities has a Hermes dwelling with her, the one an earthly Hermes, the other a heavenly one. This earthly Hermes severs the soul from the body quickly and violently, but Persephone gently and over a long time separates the mind from the soul, and for this reason she has been called only begotten. For it is only the best part of a man, when separated by her, that becomes something, one alone. And each of these two deaths comes about naturally in the following way. Every soul, whether mindless or possessed of mind, upon falling out of the body, is destined to wander for a time, not the same length of time for all, in the region between earth and moon. But the unjust and unrestrained souls pay the penalty for their wrongdoings there, while the decent souls must spend a fixed period of time in the mildest part of the air, which they call the meadows of Hades, purifying and breathing away the pollutions they have contracted from the body, as from some noxious vapor. Then, as though returning home from exile in a foreign land, they taste a joy such as those being initiated into mysteries taste, mingled above all with confusion and awe, blended with a sweet hope. For the moon repels and washes back like a wave many souls, even as they are already reaching for it. And some who are up there they see turning downward again and being submerged as if into an abyss. But those who succeed in rising and are firmly established their first go-about, like victors in a contest, crowned with wreaths called wreaths of steadfastness, made of feathers, because the irrational and passionate part of their soul has been made obedient to reason with reasonable ease and has been kept orderly during their lifetime. Secondly, in appearance they resemble a ray of light, and their soul, buoyed upward by fire, receives from the ether around the moon just as, here below, iron receives its temper, firmness, and strength, as things do when they are tempered by a quenching bath. For what was still rarefied and diffused becomes solidified and grows steady and translucent, so that it is nourished by whatever exhalation happens to reach it. And Heraclitus put it well when he said that souls in Hades perceive by smell. Now these souls behold, first of all, the size and beauty of the moon itself, and its nature, which is neither simple nor unmixed, but a kind of blend of star and earth. For just as the earth, mingled with breath and moisture, has become soft, and blood, mingled into the flesh, gives it sensation, so too, they say, the moon, being mingled with ether throughout its depth, is at once ensouled and generative, and at the same time possesses an even balance between weight and lightness. For in this way the cosmos itself, being composed of things that by nature move upward and things that move downward, has been freed altogether from motion in respect of place. Xenocrates too seems to have grasped this by some divinely inspired reasoning, taking his starting point from Plato. For it is Plato who declared that each of the stars is composed of earth and fire, joined together through intermediate natures given in proportion. For nothing, he held, can reach our perception in which no admixture of earth and light is present. Xenocrates, for his part, says that the stars and the sun are composed of fire and the first density, while the moon is composed of the second density and its own peculiar air, while the earth is composed of water and air and the third of the dense substances, and that, in general, neither the dense taken by itself nor the rarefied is capable of receiving soul. So much, then, for the substance of the moon. As for its breadth and size, it is not what the geometers say, but is many times larger, the moon measures out. But the earth's shadow only rarely exceeds the moon's own dimensions a few times over, not because of the shadow's smallness, but because of the moon's heat, by which it hastens its motion so as to pass quickly through the dark region, carrying off the souls of the good, who hurry along and cry out, for once they are in the shadow, they no longer hear the harmony of the heavens. At the same time, from below, the souls of those being punished are then borne up through the shadow, wailing and shrieking. That is why most people are accustomed, during eclipses, to beat bronze vessels and make noise and clatter on behalf of the souls. They are also frightened by the so-called face, whenever they come near it, since it appears grim and terrible to look upon. But it is not really like that. Rather, just as our own earth has deep, great gulfs, one here, poured in through the pillars of Heracles toward us, and outside, the Caspian and the seas around the Red Sea, so too these are the depths and hollows of the moon. The greatest of them they call the Hollow of Hecate, where souls pay and exact the penalties for whatever they have suffered or done once they have already become spirits, the two long ones. For the souls cross over through them, now toward the parts of the moon facing heaven, now again toward the parts facing earth. The parts facing heaven are named the Elysian plain, and the ones here the plain of Persephone, the counter-earth. The spirits do not always spend their time upon it, but come down here to attend to oracles, and they are present at and share in celebrating the highest rites, becoming, in the mystic ceremonies, both chastisers and guardians against wrongdoing, and shining forth as saviors both in wars and at sea. But whatever they do amiss in these matters, whether from anger or for the sake of some unjust favor or out of envy, they pay the penalty for it. They are thrust back down to earth again, confined within human bodies. From among those better spirits, both the followers of Cronus, so it was said, were themselves such beings. And earlier in Crete, the Idaean Dactyls had come to be, and in Phrygia the Corybantes, and around Boeotia at Audora the Trophoniidae, and countless others in many places of the inhabited world, whose shrines and honors and titles still remain, though the powers of some have faded, as they have attained a different place through the finest of transformations. Some attain it sooner, others later, whenever the intellect is separated from the soul, and it is separated out of desire for the reflection that surrounds the sun, through which shines forth what is desirable and beautiful and divine and blessed, which every nature, each in its own way, reaches for. Indeed, the moon herself, out of desire for the sun, forever circles and unites with him, longing to draw from him what is most fruitful. But there remains behind, on the moon, the nature of the soul, preserving, as it were, certain traces of a life and dreams. Concerning this, it is rightly held that the line was spoken. And the soul, like a dream, having flown away, has taken wing, for it does not undergo this at once, nor as soon as it is freed from the body, but later, when, bereft and alone, it becomes separated from the intellect. And of all that Homer said, he seems to have spoken most truly of all, and in accord with a god, concerning the dead in Hades, when he said, "And after him I recognized mighty Heracles," meaning his phantom, but he himself is among the immortal gods. For each of us is, in truth, not anger, nor fear, nor desire, any more than we are flesh or bodily fluids, but that with which we think and understand. And the soul, being molded by the intellect, and in turn molding the body and enfolding it on every side, is stamped throughout with its form, so that even if it should exist apart from either one for a long time, it preserves the likeness and the imprint, and is rightly called an image. Of these things the moon, as has been said, is the element. For into her the bodies of the dead are dissolved, just as into the earth the bodies of the dead are dissolved, quickly, the temperate souls, who at leisure have embraced a life free from business and devoted to philosophy. For, released by the intellect and no longer employing the passions for anything, they wither away and fade out. But among the ambitious, the active, those given over to desire for bodies, and the spirited, some are kept in turmoil, as though in sleep, by dreams that are memories of their life, as was true of Endymion's soul. But when instability and susceptibility to feeling drive them out of themselves and drag them away from the moon toward another birth, she does not allow it, but calls them back and charms them into calm. For it is no small, quiet, or settled task, whenever, without the intellect, they take hold of the body's passionate part. The Tityoi and the Typhons, and the one who seized Delphi and threw the oracle into confusion with insolence and violence, Typhon, were, it seems, drawn from just such souls, when their passionate part strayed through lack of reason and through delusion. But in time the moon received even these back into herself and set them in order. Then, once the sun has again sown intellect into the vital principle, she receives it and makes new souls, and the earth furnished a third body. For the earth gives nothing after death except what it receives back for a new birth. The sun receives nothing, but takes back the intellect while giving it in turn. And the moon both receives and gives, and combines and divides, according to one power and another, of which the one that combines is called Eileithyia, and the one that divides, Artemis. And of the three fates, Atropos, stationed about the sun, initiates the beginning of generation. Clotho, moving about the moon, binds together and blends. And last, Lachesis, who has the greatest share of chance, takes hold near the earth. For what is soulless is itself powerless and passive, acted upon by other things, while the intellect is impassive and self-ruling. But the soul, being mixed and intermediate like the moon, has been made by God as a blend and mingling of the things above and below, standing, then in the same relation to the sun that the earth has to the moon. "These things," said Sulla, "I myself heard the stranger relate, and to him the attendants and servants of Cronus, as he himself said, reported them. But it is for you, Lamprias, to make use of the account if you wish.